Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, the Queen of Fun. That is how a six-year-old boy once described Mimi Chenfeld. She has been teaching for 54 years, playfully and lovingly. Taught teachers, parents, and children of all ages in Canada, Taiwan, and throughout the United States. She still travels extensively. I'm glad she could squeeze us in to continue our ongoing conversation about teaching creativity and just creativity in general and teaching in general and children especially. Welcome back to the show, Mimi.
Thank you, Ann.
It's the beginning of the school year. It's hard to believe it's midterm. My son and his friend and I were having that conversation. It's midterm in some schools already, but whatever. It's still the beginning
of the
school year.
Exams?
Yeah, midterm exams.
Already?
We're over with. I know. But so it does fly by, doesn't it?
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, you hope. I mean, in fact, that's a good thing. But how should a parent – what's your recommendations or – for how parents should approach the teachers of their children?
You know, one of the greatest strengths in education is a good relationship between the parents and the teachers. And in some places that happens and it's natural and it's a tradition. You know, in these schools, the parents and or the families of the children are close to the school and they're there for different occasions and they volunteer for different events and they're visible. There are other schools and there's so many components to mm-hmm. this, but that there's a real separation. So there's just across the board in any way a family can handle this, to be close to the teachers, to say, I'm here, talk to me, I want to know what's going on, I want to hear if there's a problem, I want you to know about my kid. And teachers are generally very receptive. They want to know. They want to know that this kid is very shy, and if you really push this kid and call on him or her and say, you've got to stand up and do this, this is going to be a problem. They need to know those little things as well. And I don't think I know a single teacher who is not welcoming of parents' involvement. Not, you know, the tragedy is so many parents will call if something's wrong.
Right.
Or complain. And that's it. And, you know, sometimes teachers are dreading, oh, my goodness, I got a call from Mrs. Smith. You know, I'm dreading to call her back because it can't be good. So I think that one-dimensional way of being, you know, of being in contact with teachers is not good. You know, what's wrong? Why did you do this to my child? You know, my child should have had an A and you gave him a C, and what that kind of thing is just, you know, is just ready to start a fire. So I think there's many ways to respond to events at the school, to be there for conferences, to come in and introduce yourself and say, I really want to know all through this year. I want you to know I'm here, I'm out here. Talk to me. If there's a problem, call me. I'd be glad to come in. Those are the most important little, you know, they're not major, but they all add up and to, you know, a closer communication, and that's so important.
In high school, the teachers send out a lot of emails to parents, not tons, but every, like, once a week or something, tell us what they're doing, and it's sort of this group email. And I always respond, not with anything in particular, but thanks.
See, but Anne, you're an example of parents who are involved. You know, and there are kids, there are teachers who have, who have family conferences, and maybe one out of all their students' families come in, that nobody comes in. So we have a lot of kids out there who have no one, you know, representing them from family. It just is for many reasons. The family may be dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. They may be working and they can't.
Some people just feel intimidated by the whole thing.
Well, remember, there's an old tradition of, you know, and I'm remembering from I'm a first-generation American, so I'm remembering the stories of the school is, you know, the school is the fortress, the tower, and if your teacher calls, you know, you are, you know, oh, my goodness, it's like people used to be with doctors. You know, if the doctor says, listen, jump off this bridge, it'll really air out your problems, you know, do you jump? Because the doctor said it. And there are still families that feel that way about teachers. If the teacher said this, it's like the law. It's, you know, Moses mm-hmm. on the Mount Sinai with the tablets. You know, that there's a whole generation of people, maybe first generation Americans or old-fashioned people who feel that way about schools, and they are intimate, and they won't respond.
Mm-hmm.
They're too scared. They're too scared to come in. But in general, I think that you've got your people who are like you, who represent the kids, who are there, who are active, who are involved, who are responsive, and then there are folks who they never hear from.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no one there representing a child. And this is a big gap. This is a big gap in this country now.
My guest is Mimi Chenfeld. She is author and educator. She's been on before. I'm sure you remember her. If you'd like to speak with Mimi, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I posted on Facebook an interview that Mimi did with Artie Isaac. Artie was on the show, I think, last week or the week before. I can't remember. He video recorded it.
Oh, he did?
You didn't know this.
I thought we were just having coffee.
You can just Google.
I'm not into the machinery.
You can just Google Mimi Chenfeld, C-H-E-N-F-E-L-D, and Artie Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, and you'll find the video. It's on, he's interviewing people, the most creative people he knows, and he started with you.
Oh, he did? Mm-hmm. Well, we were just having a lovely visit.
You didn't see the camera rolling or anything?
No. No, he had his laptop with the screen up.
Oh, that's...
But, you know, you've got where people have their laptops. Well, I mean, people don't have laps anymore. They just have laptops. So I didn't even think that this was going to be
it. Warned out there. If you're sitting across the table from Artie Isaac and his computer's open and facing
and
you.
And he was the teacher of the year.
Yeah.
Artie Isaac, and he was and I have actually written about him in one of my books. He's included as a very creative teacher. And he's a joyful, spreading, you know, the excitement of creativity. You know, it's interesting, and I know I want to interrupt you, but just that the word creative is back in. We have lost a generation of kids with all the testing. We've lost, I mean, there are bright lights and there are great happenings with schools and teachers who still make room for creative and imaginative ways of teaching. But if you take a general brush and do a good sweep, we lost a generation for creativity because of the testing and the stress and the scores and the punishment and the rewards and you know, the headlines about schools being terrible. But it's now back in. Thomas Friedman is writing about it all the time.
Yes.
There's a creativity symposium
next week. But there's still people talking about making particularly higher education more functional, more to the point. In other words, if you want to be a computer programmer, why do you need to get a liberal arts education?
Yeah.
There's a lot more of slice and dicing up career paths. And taking it
out of the
venue of the liberal arts. And, of course, there's lots of the trade schools and all that kind of stuff, which is what works for some people. But even if you wanted to be a journalist, say, why do you need the whole big liberal arts? That might not be a good example, but there's a lot of other ones where people are talking about that.
You know, this is so weird. We're so, I'm so concentrating on, well, not concentrating, but, you know, on the early childhood people, because that's where the kindergarten kids are coming in and getting the first grade curriculum, and that's where kids don't want to come to school because they're scared of the seat work and the paperwork and so forth. But I didn't realize that this was happening, this limiting, this narrowing of the mind in higher education.
But it starts much younger, don't you think?
Of course.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize. I mean, you would think that this is a place where they say, doctors, you need humanities. And I was talking to Artie about this. I said, Artie, you need to take your humanistic approach to all people and your creative approach to all. He's doing a lot of work with business and with CCAD. You need to take it to medical schools. Doctors need to know how to communicate. They need to know about sociology and psychology and the arts. They need to know that this patient whose fingers are hurting is a pianist, and when his fingers are in pain, he can't play, and this is his life. You don't need to know he's just a 9:15 appointment, you know, to look at fingers. I mean, you need to go beyond the narrow focus of your vocation. And speaking of vocation, I am, more and more upset that the vocational schools are not getting the honoring and the centering that they need to get. Not every kid needs to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
Not every kid wants to go to college. Not every kid should go to college. And people who have kids who are getting pushed, you know, you need to go to college. And they think this is it. This is Mount Sinai again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were kids who, I can't function in this academic way. This isn't how I function. I want to go and learn a trade. I love it. I'm in auto mechanics. I'm in carpentry. You know, I'm in, you know, whatever the trade mm-hmm. is. I'm remembering that even when I went to school in New York City, the kids who were vocational were always looked, you know,
right.
on differently. This is sick. We need those people. We need, listen, who could be more fantastic than a plumber or an electrician? If you need an electrician, you're not going to get a philosophy professor from Ohio State who's going to give you a lecture on existentialism at that moment. You need somebody who's got a vocation, who's got a skill, who is a helper, who is needed. And the people who want to do that are passionate about it. We need to honor that, don't you think?
Yeah, and I also think that if people want to be in the trades and in some kind of trade, that they should also be welcome in academia as well if they want to pursue and feed their mind in other ways.
Absolutely.
As well.
But I think that we still have that like class thing going on with vocational.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we need to really rethink.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll get to the phone, and we'll get to the email from Charlotte, and we'll be back with Mimi Chenfeld. If you'd want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And again, if you want to check out that video of Mimi Chenfeld,
too close.
Just go to Facebook, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I'm pretty sure it's on there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. You can go behind the scenes at WOSU with our e-newsletters. Find out what our classical music hosts are listening to. Get the latest news from NPR and the WOSU newsroom. Learn about volunteer opportunities and more. Visit WOSU.org/email, and there you can sign up for one of our WOSU e-newsletters. It's 51 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19. Cloudy skies today. There is a slight chance of rain today throughout the day and a high of 58. Clouds with a chance of rain tonight, mainly after midnight, a low of 45 degrees. And Tuesday looks like a repeat of today. Cloudy skies, a chance of rain, and a high of 58. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Mimi Chenfeld, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu. Mimi has written books, one, Teaching in the Key of Life, and another, Teaching by Heart. She's written many articles, stories, and poems. They're enjoyed worldwide. Since 1970, she has taught numerous schools and programs in Columbus, Ohio, our hometown. So if you want to give a call to Mimi, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have one from Charlotte who writes, how are children coping with the prospect of vastly reduced options in this economy? Are they picking up on their parents' stress and distress? Here in my neighborhood, Hyle Elementary School, the economy has been bad for decades and kids seem to be relatively resilient. What can the community do to help our neighborhood schools? Those are kind of two questions. Mm-hmm. How are kids coping? Are you seeing any kind of feedback from them about the economy and the struggles?
Charlotte, that's a very good question and an issue that really we need to not just discuss, but we need to solve the challenges in that. First, I think kids, in across the board, are more resilient than we think. You know, I think that children handle, you know, family dynamics. In this culture right now, the dynamics of family are really challenging for children. I think they handle, neighborhood realities, you know, probably better. I didn't say that it's good for them. I just think that, you know, they're stronger than we think in how they survive it. There's a lot more kids than we think are survivors, but that's not good. I mean, why should we be putting children through that and be glad that they survive? There's an article in today's paper that I forgot what, maybe it was Dublin or someplace like that, where they're turning the school into at night like a community center to bring people in.
I think it was Dublin.
And there was a huge article about Champion Middle School in the Weekend Dispatch, which we were going to talk about later. And the whole issue of community involvement in the school is, to me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, here's a school, and that school, we could host so many things. We could host the social workers. We could host a clinic, you know, the clinic area for people to come in and check a child's health. The school could really become a center for community needs, which it already is. Look at libraries. Look what libraries have turned into. And I'm wearing my library shirt, so everybody votes yes on the library. The library vote, November 2nd. Please, everybody, support the libraries. But the libraries have responded to community needs. So they're not, it's no longer just you go to the library and you get a book and you check it out and you leave. Go to a library, there are courses, there are counselors,
lectures,
there are tutoring,
seminars,
there's lectures. So the schools, I do think community has to be part of the schools, and they should partner with like the community centers and the churches and the synagogues in the mosques in the neighborhood, so that there is a relationship, that they offer things that people will want, that people need, and come in, so that the people physically, literally, from the community are in those schools. Otherwise, if you have children, are you in the schools? And then we were talking about half of you are not in the schools. So I hope that makes some sense. And do I worry about children with narrowing? I think we're losing millions of young people who feel they have no future, no present, no past. They're completely alienated, and it's not an easy solution in sight for those kids. I just wrote the president, believe it or not. I constantly write the president. Dear Barack, I did. I wrote this. I go to the post office and go, oh, no, she's solving the world's problems again. But I really believe that there's a chance for him to call a summit kind of the kids' heroes, the hip-hop guys and the athletes. And they have tremendous influence on the children. And to bring them together and say, look, we are losing so many of our kids because they don't feel they have choices. They don't feel they have a place in this society. They're just out there on the streets. And they're out there, you know, with no goal, with no reason in sight. And so they're alien. They're amoral. They're alienated. So I think we have to, you know, you take a person like Jackie Calderon. She is getting honored next week by the Greater Columbus Arts Council as arts educator. She started the Third Avenue Church on High Street to turn that church into a center of the community.
That's right.
And kids, and now she's got Transit Arts, which is bringing in high school kids and junior high kids from the neighborhoods that Charlotte described. And they're writing poetry and they're doing music and they're teaching each other and they're positive influences. People like that are, you know, these are our leaders, and we really need this. This is a focus we really need, or we're going to lose another generation of kids. So I deeply respect that question that you asked.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. And Mike, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm really enjoying your program, and the thing that made me pick up the phone and call was when you were talking about, you know, like the trade schools and things like that. I graduated, you know, like in the 60s, and I think in the 60s and maybe up till the 70s, the high schools, a lot of them had industrial arts departments.
Right. That's right.
But then they kind of went to like vocational school. So if you were taking that line of study, they sent you off to do it.
That's right.
They kind of regionalized it, or magnet schools.
They made it either or.
Yeah, but
that's right.
One of the things that I think is, you know, when guidance counselors talk to kids and when they have people come and talk about career days. If the career I got into has to do with computer-aided design and robotics, and if I think that if some of the kids in the high schools could see what we do in these automated factories and see some of the machines, and, you know, like I can, on my computer screen, I can concept something apart, and then I can create the data to turn it from my imagination into a real part that gets produced on a production line, and, you know, and you can see that whole process. I would think that if a lot of the kids in high school that, you know, enjoy being on the computer, enjoy computer games and things like that, if they could see where that career could lead them, there might be more kids would choose that path.
They're just kind of disconnected from
that avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, I think you made some wonderful points, and I actually forgot that part of most of the high school. I grew up in New York City, and every high school had at that time a Department of Industrial, what do they call it?
Industrial Arts.
Industrial Arts. And kids were taking that as well as the academic subjects. And then you're right, they just turned into the vocational schools. So the idea of integrating it in regular schools to me is wonderful, and not separating the kids who want to do both. You know, I said before, you don't want a professor of existentialism in the philosophy department to come over and fix your electricity. But I was just thinking after I said that, you know, maybe this professor of philosophy took some electrical engineering in high school, and he could do both.
You could get a lecture on existentialism.
Right, and as he's fixing your electricity, you could get a lecture on existentialism.
I actually, from some people I have gotten those kind of lectures while they're fixing stuff.
One more thing.
Sure.
How many times do you hear these stories about people who, at the end of a career, you know, like in investment banking or, a high-stress career, they just get burned out and they buy a cabin someplace, and they make furniture, or they become a carpenter, or, you know, an artist, you know. Well, if you already had those skills to begin with, you know, it just seems to me like it makes you a more well-rounded person, and you don't necessarily need to be pushed into investment banking either.
Well, Mike, I have one thing to say to what you said. Amen.
Thanks for your call, Mike.
Okay.
Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email from Hal. He writes, I'm glad people are celebrating, but isn't the pressure for race to the top funds for teachers and administrators to teach more and more intensely to the test? As a retired educator, I worry that we persist in teaching our students to be political and artistic sheep and technocrats. Now, the race to the top funds, I think that was about $400 million that the state of Ohio was awarded from the federal government. There is an emphasis on testing styles and that kind of a thing. And you're not a big fan of testing either.
If you've ever heard me on with Ann or over the years, let me try to use good language. I'm just so worried. I'm anxious. I'm angry, frustrated about this whole testing push, and narrow way of evaluating teachers and children. I think within the race to the top, there may be, maybe some windows of possibility for teachers to do more creative things. But again, it's very test-driven. And the test-driven era we're living in is what we're talking about, with creativity being squashed. And, you know, great thinkers who are looking at our society are saying, what happened to America as the creative capital of the world? It used to be, you know, the Japanese are the people who really were educated, and their system was wonderful, even though the kids, you know, and they didn't get a good test mark, you know, shaved off their eyebrows and stuck themselves with you know, knives because they were so upset. They were, you know, they were making a self-destructive statement because they didn't, you know, this emphasis on their achieving test scores was so incredible. So we used to say the Japanese are really teaching their kids, even though these methods are a little hard, you know, and these kids are really under pressure. But in America, we have creative thinking, and we have problem solving, and we have initiative energy going into their learning.
That used to be a bragging point, didn't it?
We used to be that. And then the testing era came, and that was squashed. So now people like Thomas Friedman are saying, where's the creative energy coming from our students?
You know, a lot of the testing came out of, at least from the state legislature, when I covered it, came from the idea that how do you measure success? They were looking for measurements. They wanted to measure success. They wanted to be able to measure how effective a teacher was, and that would somehow manifest itself in children's grades on tests.
And it also came out of one of the initial reasons to do the massive testing and emphasize it was to say, we need to know where these kids need intervention. That was the original idea as well, Anne. Like, we need to know that your kid is doing great in language, great in history, great in science, but math, there's some problems. We need to get extra help in. He needs a math, you know, emphasis there, tutoring, you know.
And if they could see a trend line in a school, then maybe that was telling
them. That's what they wanted to do. That was the original. So we could put in some supplemental help. It turned into what you said. It turned into, and you know what else? We are in such a frustrating fast food, instant gratification culture that if we don't get a result like that, you're a failure. And they don't know that teaching is not, you know, is not a fast food profession. There are kids who come back 20 years later and say, Mrs. Fisher, remember you taught me in fourth grade? Well, it really helped me, and now I'm doing this. But, of course, I haven't spoken to you in 25 years to tell you how much it meant to me and what I've become because of it. It's not the same measurements. It's not the same way of measuring. And the language they use is the language of the marketplace. The kids are like products. You know, the testing is, you know, like their accountability is all in numbers. And children aren't. This, human beings don't fit into that kind of thinking. And that is the thinking of all this legislation. That's where we're fighting it so fiercely. I tell people I want to live to see a change. To see a change back to more human, wider way of evaluating children and assessing teachers and measuring. You can't measure just statistics. You could have the greatest score in the world and be a complete dumbass, a dumb person.
614-292-8513.
Sorry.
Mark, you're on the air with Mimi Chenfeld. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Mimi. I very much appreciate your thoughts on these, and I had a question I wanted to bring up, that what you just said reminded me. I had a kindergarten teacher at Clinton Elementary, Mrs. Wadlington, who very much stressed play and creativity, and a sixth grade teacher at Barrington Elementary in Arlington, Mrs. Barbara Boggs, who really pushed a love of literature, and it really, really helped me. And the strange thing is, Mrs. Boggs just passed away about 2 weeks ago. And right about the time she passed away, I had this strange urge, like, I need to look at that book, A Wrinkle in Time, again, that she read to our class.
Yes.
It's great. And so much was relevant to what's happening in the world today. And so those teachers can really bring out good things. My question, I guess, for you would be, in the Columbus Dispatch this last Saturday, there was a really wonderful commentary article by a fellow, older fellow, who'd grown up in an orphanage school.
Bill Chavon, right.
Yeah, and he was bringing up something which my mother's expressed her angst with over the years, that if an orphanage or a boarding school is well-run, it can be very, very good for the students. And he brought up what typically happens now is children are constantly rotated between dysfunctional relatives and often just for in the money, foster cares, and the kids really get screwed up. And maybe if done properly, an orphanage boarding school system would be better for very, very troubled children than what the children's services do now. And I'll take it off the air, and your thoughts on those matters. Thank you.
Yeah, Mark, Bill Chavon was talking about the Sailor and Soldiers Home for Orphans that was down in Xenia, ran for 125 years.
Nice.
We actually had a program about it. And there's a – Ed Lentz has a new book out. He wrote a book about it. And That's what he was talking about.
Right. And how appreciative he was for the years he spent there.
Right.
Right. But, you know, I think what Mark hit the one point that's the most relevant in that question, which is well run and meeting the needs of the kids. You know, if it's a choice between children being bounced from foster home to aunt or uncle or cousin who isn't really tuned into his or her welfare, I would always pick the place where there's the most security, the most encouragement, the most stimulation, and the most feeling of a connectiveness to other people. And if you call it, you know, we have a terrible one, we call it an orphanage, because those are the old, you know, terms.
A lot of pejoratives.
Yeah, a lot of pejoratives. But I think, you know, given a choice between a child bounced from relative to relative and not accomplishing, not succeeding, feeling alienated in half the places he or she, we have kids who change schools like 3 or 4 times a year here. And kids who never show up will come, and then they just, you know, don't come back. So if it's a choice between a child lost out there or a community, whether you call it an orphanage or what, where there's security and safety and a lovingness and warmth and encouragement, I mean, what would your choice be for that child? Mm-hmm. But that means you have to guarantee these places are those, just what they described.
And you also have to make a decision about what child would be better off there. And nowadays, with we're so very entrenched in the foster care system and that kind of thing, it's an interesting question.
I think it really is a wonderful question. Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking, my friend is coming back from Israel, and she was born in a kibbutz, the old traditional kibbutz. She's like 60 now, and she grew up in the kibbutz that who wrote about Children of the Dream. I forgot the name of the writer, famous Children of the Dreamer. The idea, it was an idealistic way of looking at community. And they had a children's house on the kibbutz in Israel. And, you know, it was a community in a piece of land, and each family had their own little area to live in. But then there was a general children's house, and all the children grew up in the children's house and were taken care of by people in the community. They all worked in the community, and everything came back to that. It was like nonprofit. They all shared everything. It was a total, you know, idealistic communal place. Mm-hmm. And she, of course, always, you know, regrets that she didn't live with her mom and dad in their little house. And they'd go there like for the Sabbath and stay till Sunday, and then go back to the children's house. But I was thinking about that for a lot, because she just came back. Her father is 90, and he still lives on that kibbutz. And so she's there with him now, and she was remembering growing up that way. But that was, she had loving parents. But if you ask a child who's bounced from place to place and not happy in any of them and wondering where do I fit, and say, would you like to go to this place where children are loved and you'll be with other children and you'll be cared for and you'll go to school and we will be behind you and we will help you? I mean, I think many children would say, yes, I'd rather do that. So, you know, when you're talking about children, it's such a sacred way of thinking that you can't just say, okay, I believe this.
Right.
You know, I think it's every child has its own unique, situation mm-hmm. to decide.
We have to take a break. My guest is Mimi Chanfeld. If you'd like to speak with Mimi, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get back to the phone and the emails when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Terry Gross interviewed Jon Stewart of The Daily Show recently in New York at the 92nd Street Y. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen to that interview recorded on stage before a live audience. Join us.
And that's coming up on Fresh Air in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 51 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Clouds today with a chance of rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 58. A few clouds with a slight chance of rain tonight and a low of 45. And cloudy again for Tuesday, and that chance of rain sticks around for tomorrow, a high of 58.
Support for WOSU comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students offering a parent seminar on solving reading problems, Tuesday, October 5th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org.
And in public radio, listener feedback is very important. We'd like to hear your thoughts on our radio programming, including All Sides with Ann Fisher. So NPR has partnered with WOSU. We're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we want you to be a part of it. All you have to do is go to WOSU.org/survey. There you can sign up and send us your thoughts. And All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about creativity and how to nurture it in children. My guest is Mimi Chenfeld. We have calls waiting, 614-292-8513, and also an email. I guess let's take the email first. They write, I agree with you, some people are more suited to for the trades. We need plumbers. The world will fill up with only professors and nobody will be able to go to the bathroom. Okay. Point well taken. In elementary school in the 1950s, I was geared toward the trades with my aptitude toward math. In college, I pursued the higher levels of math. My point is that we realize our strengths and weaknesses as we move through life, but we need teachers to guide us there. That's an interesting idea, what we realize about ourselves as we move through life. There's not something set in stone, they're saying.
Very well said.
The day you're born.
And I like the way, I think it was Mark or Hal who said, you know, people who retire from being investment bankers suddenly realize how much they love carpentry or art or nature. I think we need teachers. To me, teaching is a sacred calling. It's as simple as that. I truly equate teaching with a religious calling. And when I'm with teachers, I say, if this is not a sacred calling, you really need to change careers because it's too hard. I mean, first of all, the whole culture dumps on teachers. Teachers, you know, it's their fault
they're
for right everything.
They're with lawyers and journalists now.
No, teachers are still ahead and getting dumped on.
Okay. I mean, really? You think?
I mean, you have a way to go. The media people and lawyers. I mean, if anything's wrong, it's the teachers, and we need to get. Listen, I am not that Pollyanna that I think all teachers are absolutely wonderful, and those who aren't should really find. We should find a way for them to say, you know, let's change careers. It's not really working, and try to make it easier. But I would say, by and large, most of the teachers I know, and I know, you know, many, and this is firsthand, are dedicated, are caring, are loving, want the kids to succeed, are trying to find ways to get through this morass of standards and goals and benchmarks and test scores. I mean, it's really hard to get through all that and still connect with the kids in meaningful ways. Do I think teachers are there to guide? Absolutely. And influence, even if they don't realize they're influencing. And the things that they love and share, children often I'm just remembering a friend, Roger Gerhardstein, who taught English I forgot what school. I think Grove City. I think he was in Groveport or Grove City. Anyway, at the high school. And he came in one day with a book he was reading. And the kids, you know, it was on his desk. And when they had a break, he read his book. When they had 10 minutes silent reading, he read his book. And the kids came up and said, what are you reading? What are you reading, Mr. Garrison? He told them, well, love this book. Love it. It's a wonderful book. And later on, he spoke to the school librarian, and she said, what happened today? What did you assign? Let's pretend it was Hemingway.
Okay.
And he said, I didn't assign anything to you. He says, well, your whole class came in and asked for books by Ernest Hemingway. And we haven't got any more left on the shelves because they all took them. Why? He meant so much to them. This is something he loved. Mm-hmm. And even without realizing it, he was inspiring.
Right.
So I can't talk enough about the importance of teachers guiding kids in every way.
Pat, you're on the air with Mimi Chenfeld. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Ann, and good morning, Mimi.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, and you have helped so many people with their creative lives, and you helped me early on with my creative path, so thank you very much.
Oh, my goodness.
And I wanted to ask you this question. When your good creative spirit is challenged by life setbacks or silly bureaucratic actions or negative Nellies, how do you stay positively charged?
Well, first I'm in denial. well, you know, you're talking about when. I'm saying every day it's challenged, every single day. Just open the paper, turn on the news, you know, get a call from – I had a call this morning from a friend. She called from school. She called at a break before I came on the station, and she was – you know, she was in the middle of school. She says, are you going to be on? Don't let them dump on teachers. Are some of the political candidates talking about teachers' unions getting demolished? You know, and she is just every single day. You know, we live on distress, and we do not live in boring times, Pat. Remember that.
That's right. But you always fight the good fight, and I'm so proud of you.
And I think really you just have to stick to, you know, you stick to what you believe no matter what. Because the things I believe so fervently that I believe them so fanatically that I just can't give in to any. I mean, I listen to it. I listen to the opposition and the criticism and the hatred and the violence and the viciousness and the meanness. And I mean, you can't help it. You're living in this culture that's a very charged culture. But, you know, you say, do I really believe what I believe? And I think it challenges you to say, do you really believe this, or are you getting, you know, are you getting moved by all the criticism and all the points people make? And you just have to say, this is what I believe, and act on it.
You and Ann are beacons of light in our city, and I'm so glad you're both here. So thanks very much.
Well, we're glad you're there, Pat.
Thank
you're
you,
welcome.
Pat.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 614-292-8513. Ken, you're on the air with Mimi Chenfeld. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Ken.
Hi. I was wondering about the Singapore math plan. And in Singapore, the kids have the highest test scores in the world in math. Mm. And the Singapore math plan is based on concepts, not on memorization and creativity within math. And they've had tremendous results with it. And I know that some schools in the United States have gone to it partially. You know, and maybe Japan goes to it partially. Other countries go on to it partially. Do you think we can learn from any of these other concepts, the other plans?
Ken, we can learn from everything that works. And I have to explore that. It sounds fabulous. Because, you know, one of the things, and Ann mentioned this before, you know, children on their path, where are they going to go? What's in the future for them? And what kind of careers will open up for our children who are in schools today? And one of the things is learning how to learn, not just rote memory. So you're bringing up such a very, you know, very important way of learning, which is, again, the concept. You know, there were kids who, now I don't know about you, but I grew up in New York City, and we had the Regents, and we had to memorize. The Regents tests were not as definitive as the testing, you know, nowadays, but it was pretty rigorous, and we had to memorize. You know, we had to memorize facts. So you would memorize just a whole body of facts. You'd go in, you'd ace the test, you get it. And then somebody would say, now tell me, do you know about the Civil War? You go, hell no, I don't know anything about it, but I can give you all my memorization. So the idea of, and how many tests have you taken where right after the test you forgot the material? You know, mm-hmm. I aced the test, but I really don't know the material that well. So I think the idea of learning through the concepts and understanding how you came up with formulas to, you know, to memorize is fabulous. We can learn from everything that works. We should be the most open, experimental society in the world. So I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you,
Ken.
Sure. That's interesting. It sort of reminded me of in Montessori school, I want to call them toys. The kids think they're toys, but they're
manipulatives.
Yeah, manipulatives, and a lot of them are geometrically and math, you know, based. but they're only conceptual. They're not telling you to learn math.
Because they know that people learn through these ways. Mm-hmm. We don't this is going back to, we've talked about it forever, the multiple intelligences. Some people learn very well manipulating objects and playing with Legos and discovering, you know, physics concepts by building something making conclusions about the material. We learn different ways, and when we take all those other ways away and only learn with here's the textbook, here's your worksheet, this is how you're going to learn it, we're limiting the success of many children who don't learn that way. They need hands-on, and they will be fabulous once they have that opportunity. Mm-hmm. So we have to open the opportunities, expand the opportunities for kids to succeed. No kids really fail. We fail them because we narrow their opportunities to succeed.
If you want to give us a call, you can, 614-292-8513. If you want to see Mimi Chenfeld, you
don't
can
look.
Turn on your television. We're broadcasting live now on Ohio Government Television, and you can join that show if you want, and check it out when you get a chance. It's also streaming live on WOSU.org/allsides if you want to go just to the website and see what's happening there. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, though, and speak with Mimi Chenfeld. Michelle, you're on the line, or on the air. You're on the line, too. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. What a privilege it is to be able to call into this wonderful human being, and thank you for having this topic on public radio.
You're welcome.
I am a early childhood educator at a preschool with a Reggio inspired environment.
Excellent.
And my question is, if Mim is aware of any elementary schools or junior high schools or high schools in Central Ohio or in the United States, let's just, you know, is there anything out there that is basing their curriculum or environment on the Reggio philosophy?
You know, Michelle, that's a good question. I have to.
And the reason why I ask this is because after seeing in early childhood an environment where this is what we're going to do this month, with teachers pulling out their theme for October is pumpkins. Well, my philosophy is I don't really give two hoots about pumpkins. I'm more interested in what can I build with my Legos, running and playing outside. That's where my math and my creativity as, let's just say, for example, as a 4 or 5 year old. And so I think that as those 4 and 5 year olds who have that ability to explore what they are interested in, those interests become what their passion is. And I think that's where a lot of children are so disheartened. I have 7 and 8 year old boys, and I see it in them in public schools that, you know, we're learning about planets right now. Okay. Is that something that you're really interested in? You know, what can you tell me about that? Well, my very excellent mother serves me, you know, they're it's rote. It's memorization. It's not what they're passionate
Mars,
about.
Venus. Okay.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And while these things are, you know, important throughout our lives, I think that you're hitting it right on the head. The creativity has to be allowed to flourish, and the environment as an educator. So that's why I was asking. I didn't know if there was anything in the country that you knew about as far as being Reggio inspired. And I thank you so much for what you've done. I'll
Thanks, Michelle.
Michelle, you brought up a whole bunch of very good points. Let me, in no order of importance, but circular. First, there are many schools, and I don't know if they're distinctly Reggio. For those who don't know what Reggio Emilia is, an area in Italy where, and there's a very important part here, Michelle, the community, the city, is 100% behind the school system, 100%. And so they're completely involved with the support and the relationship with the school, with the schools that have the arts as the center. So it's an expanded arts program using environment, using where the kids are to go on to continue on. It's like an ongoing. It's not like Tuesday we're going to look at a spider because Ann Fisher is interested in spiders and she brought spiders in, but it might be the kids are like spiders. We want to look at stories about spiders, sculptures about spiders, how spiders move, spiders. So it's really to celebrate it on many, many different levels. I'm sure Michelle could tell much, much more about it, but it's a very arts-centered curriculum. Second, there are many schools. I'll just give you Indianola in the Columbus Public Schools. Indianola is an arts integrated school, and they have been for years and years, and the arts are at the center and connected to curriculum all the time. As a matter of fact, they have one of the highest test scores in the city without making testing their center because the arts are the center. And you take a school like Duxbury, I'm sure, and there's a middle school art school now going on. And, of course, you have Fort Hays in Columbus, which is an arts offering school, and CAS, which has the arts quite highly centered. So, I mean, you have schools that have, they may not be Reggio, but they may be arts integrated, arts impact schools. So I was just giving you some Columbus examples. Second, you know, I have a way of talking about what you discuss, which I talked about in a lot of my books and with teachers. I call it the magic vocabulary, and that is every child, every person has a magic vocabulary of those things, those topics that are the most dear, closest, most receptive to imagination and to excitement. Every child has a list of those, and some kids they'll wear it, they'll taste it. You mean they're focused on, you know, I love superheroes. Those are my anything that's superheroes. Whatever I do is going to have to do with superheroes. So, a teacher tuning into that has 2/3 of success already because you're relevant to the children. So you're absolutely right about that. If it's somebody's excited about a topic, that's when they're going to learn everything. And we need to have time to find out what those topics are for kids. But going back, the planets, that's part of a curriculum. So it's kind of you need both. And the teachers who are going to teach the planets have a choice of making it fabulous and fascinating and enticing your child who may not be interested in it into the topic because it's so exciting and interesting how we're going to do it. And so you've got the combination of the curriculum says this is what you're studying and there's still time to do those things that are your passion. I think that's you know, the combination is really more realistic than one either or. Does that help?
Michelle, sure. Did that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, all right. Thanks for your call, Michelle.
I'm sorry I'm so blah, blah, blah today.
You're not blah, blah,
long-winded, blah. Long-winded.
There's always lots to talk about when it comes to education, and I want to thank you for joining us again today, Mimi Chenfeld.
Thank you. Are we out of time?
We're out of time.
Well, anybody can call me.
My voice starts to get sad. We're out of time.
Thank you, Ann.
My guest has been Mimi Chenfeld. She is the author of several books, including her two collections, Teaching in the Key of Life and Teaching by Heart. She's written many articles and stories, and you can see her online. If you just Google her, there's a video of her if you want to see her. And you can also maybe watch her right now while we're broadcasting live. That's all the time we have for now, though. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I want to say thanks to all the folks that make it possible. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. The All Sides staff includes producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, student production assistant Jeff Steiner, WOSU radio intern Leticia Wiggins, radio operations director Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician Eric French. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, featuring the U.S. premiere of the latest work by Belgian company Les Ballets C'est de la Baie, Out of Context for Pina, Friday, October 8th in Ohio State's Thurber Theater. Details at wexarts.org.